I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 and was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. Welcome, Fadi.
Thank you very much for having me.
Where are you from initially?
I'm Lebanese. I was born in Beirut, but grew up in Jordan. My family is there, my roots are mostly there.
How old were you when you moved to Jordan?
My father moved in the very early 60s, we followed maybe two, three times. So I was about 3-4 years old.
What was the impetus for his moving to Jordan?
My father was in the airline business, but he was a political activist, he was involved in a political party then in Lebanon that had tried to take over government. A familiar Middle East story. I'm sorry, there's the cliche there. And then eventually, because he was part of the leadership, he was sentenced to death.
You were so young at the time, but do you remember those days of being transported?
I have a vivid memory of us crossing the border by car and my sister crying. They didn't want us to leave. So we had a scuffle with my mother did with the customs people then, who ended up, because of my sister crying so much, ended up letting us go. So I have this vision in my mind of us struggling at the border.
What did your father do in Jordan?
Well, my father comes from a relatively very poor family. My grandfather was a tram driver for the longest period of time, but he was a visionary in making sure that his 9 kids went to school. And my father was the eldest. So coming from such a background meant that you had to work harder. He left and came and studied here in NYU, by the way. He's an NYU grad from their aeronautics engineering school. He came here specifically to run away from politics. He had never seen an aircraft, and he chose aeronautics because he knew he didn't have to go to college locally because they didn't teach it, because he wanted to get away.
And did he take
a freshman, he took a ship, took him a month. And he spent 5 years here, worked. His first job was at American Airlines in Chicago. And then family pressure brought him back.
So your father makes his way back to the Middle East. Your father befriended the king and started Royal Jordanian Airlines.
Yeah.
How did he go from being a refugee to having this stature?
At that time, the politics of the region had King Hussein aligned with certain groups, and my father's group seemed to have been aligned with him at that time. Mm-hmm. And thus, when he ended up in Jordan as a political refugee, it was a natural connection. And thus, being an aeronautics engineer, and maybe one of the first 2 or 3 aeronautics engineer in the Arab world then, so what else was he going to do? And he had helped start an airline with a friend of his in Lebanon before that. So aeronautics engineer, entrepreneur, Jordan, small country, needed an airline. And there you go.
Now, you were watching this as you were growing up. Did you have any ambitions to follow him in the airline business? Or what were your thoughts as far as a career was concerned?
You know, my memory is is vague on this because maybe I didn't have any ambitions as such. I was a hyperactive kid, so my memory of myself was running around all the time, doing naughty and crazy things that scared the heck out of my mom. But I didn't think of what was I going to do in life, really. I didn't think long term. But I watched him. I watched him. I watched his political activism. He still is an incredible role model. The people he connected with were extremely interesting. So we lived a fascinating life, if you want.
And you went back to Lebanon to study at the American school there.
Yes. I'm surprised you got that. But in 1967, as you know, there was the Arab-Israeli war. We used to go to Beirut every summer for vacation out of Jordan. So, and that summer, June of 67, the war broke out. We were in Beirut vacationing. We didn't come back. So I ended up spending 3 years in boarding school in Beirut. I was actually It didn't work out for me in boarding school, so they basically kicked me out, and I went back to the family.
Well, you went to boarding school as a you were 10 years old.
I was a baby,
right?
Oh my God! I still say that to myself. Independent, believe it or not, I used to get something called gate pass, which means it allows me to go out of school during weekends. And at 10 years old, I would take the bus and go to my grandparents' house, which is about a 45-minute, an hour drive. So I would go to the bus station, change buses. I still remember that and say, I would never let my kids even walk in the street nowadays. Mm-hmm. But I did that. It shaped part of my character.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 when Fadi was 22 years old, and Aramex was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. You ultimately made your way to the United States, to George Washington University,
yes,
for college. Yes. What were your first impressions of the United States?
Well, I carried a heck of a lot of responsibility then because I came to the U.S. with my mom and my baby sister who had a learning disability. I was the only one driving then, so my sister went to a children's hospital, a special education program in D.C. So I had to basically wake up very early in the morning and drive her to school every single day for a full year while being a freshman and part of the swim team at GW. And my impression was the ease at 18 years. It's easy for a teenager to actually make his way around in the U.S. Most of the American students at that time were working to either support themselves or their tuition or their living. In the Middle East, unfortunately, that's unheard of. Our families provide for us until we get married and find a job. So that was fascinating for me. I was embarrassed sometimes to say that I didn't work. It was embarrassing. Your father pays for your tuition? Was like, wow. That was a standard question at that time. And it made me feel uncomfortable eventually, so I stopped talking about it.
You talk about the ease. Are you talking about even in the mundane life, like
ease,
the roads?
Like getting a driver's license. It took me nothing. You know, you did your eye exam and then you sit behind the computer and the driving test was cakewalk, easy.
So it's ironic you say that because we Americans do not think the DMV is easy. We think it's a logistical nightmare.
You guys need to see what happens in the rest of the world and to appreciate of what your DMV is. And then eventually renewal was via mail. That's unheard of anywhere in the world today.
It's the first time we've heard of the DMV being an example of efficiency.
Right. Well, life is, things are relative. So you need to see what happens somewhere else to appreciate what you have.
What about negative impressions of the United States when you were first here?
Negative impressions in my early days was, and I'm sorry to say that, is the ignorance of world affairs and specifically of the Middle East. It was very frustrating for me, but fantastically, you know, probably if you want to ask me what was the single most important thing that I learned in the U.S. is how to understand the causes that I care for in the Middle East and know how to argue them in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I used to think that it was a natural. We used to think that we have a just cause, and just causes sell themselves. But the reality, nothing sells itself unless you're able to argue it and argue it well and know your facts very well. So from the early days, it was also my first exposure to Jews. It was my first exposure to an argument on the Arab-Israeli conflict. So I basically had to understand democracy, understand argument, understand debate well, and knowing how to present yourself was such an essential. Again, coming from a political family, I automatically became a political activist here with the Arab Students Union. And there was, you know, at that time, it was so heated. And I looked a bit, you know, I had a big beard and my hair was long and I looked like a bit of a revolutionary.
Here you were in a very politicized, heated environment. What about your academic life? What did you focus on?
Oh, you know, I started, my first year was, I went into engineering school. And then I failed miserably. I had an F in in a physics class, it didn't work out for me with engineering. I automatically changed into political science. I think it's also a very important step for me because in political science, I also got to understand the habit of reading. And that helped me a lot in my entrepreneurial life.
So you leave George Washington, you graduate, and you start Aramex out of college by accident. You met your co-founder, Bill Kingston,
yes,
in the United States.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, Bill knew my dad. So, and I stumbled into him. I think we were at the Paris Air Show. FedEx was just happening in the U.S. back then. He said, this is an interesting business. Maybe we should do something in the Middle East. Cool. Why not? I am ready. And then he arranged that I go to see the FedEx hub in Memphis. And there was a company called Purelator Courier then in the U.S. Most people don't remember it now, but it used to be bigger than FedEx, believe it or not. Obviously, these were massive for me. FedEx, aircrafts, Middle East does not fit into that. Went back to Amman to start the business.
Here you are doing all this research, going yes. from courier company to courier
right.
company in the United States.
Yes.
But you're a maverick. You seemed a little unreliable and heated.
Yeah.
Why?
I still am.
Why would Bill trust you to start this business in
Bill,
the Middle East?
Well, you know, it's not a question of trust. He was basically talking to my father, not to me. A logical man would never get into this business because it's a very, very difficult business to get into because you're effectively having to build a global network from day one. I mean, that's the nature of the beast.
Right. What were the first steps that you took to build Aramex?
Well, the first steps that we took is after I looked at the study that Bill had done, we threw it in the garbage, obviously, because it was done by an American company who tapped into research and information about the region, which still doesn't exist today. Forget about that. Threw that in the garbage, and we started researching how do you register a company. And at that time, post offices would not allow anybody to get in because they thought we were their competitors, and this was a monopolistic situation for them. The law did not allow for courier companies. But DHL and ourselves were at the forefront of actually fighting for deregulation and allowing people like us to establish the mail delivery business. We also stumbled simultaneously onto the fact that a lot of the American companies then, FedEx, UPS, Burlington, Purelator, Airborne Express, they gave their packages to deliver in the Middle East. They gave them to competitors like DHL and TNT at that time. Click to us. This is where the niche is. You establish an independent network in the region to deliver packages for these guys who are not interested to be in the Middle East at that time.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, the leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai. We'll hear more from Fadi coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Aramex was founded in 1981 and was the first Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ in 1997. So the way you got in the door was by being a supporter of the FedExes in the Middle East. And you weren't their competitor at the time. You were seen as a partner of theirs.
This was our selling point. We said, we're independent. We'll build a network for you. We will customize. Even the word customization was not there yet. But we actually delivered for every single competitor. Aramex was their single source of delivery. They all gave us their packages in the Middle East, so they had one address in the Middle East, even though they hated each other here. We were able to answer a phone for FedEx. We had an Airborne phone, and we had an Emery phone and a Purelator phone, and we delivered on their paperwork. The FedEx brand was there through me. So for them, it was a natural. They didn't have to do anything. We had an office here in New York, and all FedEx needed to do, or Airborne, was to deliver at our JFK office, which still exists today. And from there, we took it all the way. So they didn't have to think of customs, procedures, anything. Just give it to me there, and we'll take it. And eventually, we opened an office in New York, in Paris, London, and in Hong Kong and in Singapore to do exactly the same thing for other courier companies in other parts of the world, so that nobody had to think about shipping into the Middle East because it was a bit complicated. Where's the Middle East? We didn't know. The geography was not even known then.
So you were this, you were the wholesaler and you were the courier to these couriers.
Absolutely. We were the courier of couriers, if you want, to the Middle East. So we were a known brand to the industry.
Did you know you wanted to branch out on your own after servicing FedEx and these other couriers, learning on their dime?
Yes.
At what point did you say, you know what, I want to eventually compete with these guys?
Yeah, well, I would have loved to stay doing their stuff because it was easy stuff. I didn't have to have retail operations or anything. But the reality of the matter is we knew that they will eventually go global. We started seeing them acquiring companies in Europe. We started seeing them acquiring companies in Asia. So the minute they say they're global, they, it means the Middle East. So they can do it two ways in the Middle East, either acquire us or go set up their own operation. We've had some discussions with some of them about acquisitions, but we never came to a conclusion, luckily, because the value of the company today and every day that we refused any offer increased.
What was the delta between FedEx and Airborne Express's perception of you as a reliable company in the Middle East to do their work and the reality of what you were? Like, what level of improvisation had to happen?
Oh, plenty of improvisation. So we built the business on the backs of our clients, meaning, you know, I learned the business from Federal Express and Airborne Express. I mean, I understood my limitations very well, and I understood their power so well. And I took advantage of it to the hilt, meaning every time I had the chance to meet, learn, send people from my company to get trained by these guys, we did. And we did that by pushing them very hard to take our kids to get trained by them. And that's how we learned the business. I know everything that I need to know about this industry today because of FedEx and Airborne Express. They taught us the business and they paid us for it. Mm. The other thing that you need to know is their ignorance in the early days of the region, and I can say that now, led me to do things that they didn't know. Meaning, I would have claimed that I had a full network. That was not a lie, but that was not the full truth either. So, meaning I always had somebody somewhere to deliver a package for me, but it didn't mean it was my employee. I always found someone, a taxi driver here or a travel agent there, and I would say, you know, call him and say, here's an airway bill coming to you on this airline. Please go to customs and clear it and deliver it. And say you're from Aramex. Mm. Because the reality of the matter is, as all startups are, and especially in the Middle East, we were undercapitalized. We were not sure we were going to make it. And so you needed to improvise. I was regularly taking a flight from Amman, our hub then, to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia and have packages with me.
You were the delivery boy.
I was the delivery boy. I would check into a hotel, literally check into a hotel, wake up very early next morning, grab a cab, tell him I have these 10 addresses. I would go and deliver every package to these people and go back in the afternoon and do my business meetings so that I can try to get my license. So, but nobody knew that then. Mm-hmm. Nobody, I would knock on these doors and say, I have this package. But I was the founder of this company delivering those packages. And that's how I learned the business.
This was in the early 1980s. If I had told you then that you would be a billion-dollar company in 2010, would you have been surprised? Or
I would have been absolutely surprised. Our market cap when we were public on NASDAQ in 1997 never exceeded $70 million. Yeah, small micro cap. $1 billion, my God, you know, at the height of this company, when we went public on the Dubai Stock Exchange, we actually hit $2 billion. And so, wow. I mean, this is incredible for us.
You mentioned FedEx. The founder of FedEx is Fred Smith.
Yes.
Did you meet him?
I met Fred Smith, and I know exactly how I met him. So I went to every single conference on the industry that could happen during those days. I was still in my 20s. So Fred Smith was a keynote speaker at one of those conferences. And I said, I have to meet this man. So right before he finished, I waited at the door. And I'm a shy man in general. And before people attacked, I came to him and said, you know, I am so and so, and I have this small company. And then he was nice. He said, yes, nice to meet you. And from then on, I kept following him, believe it or not. Wherever he was a keynote speaker, I would follow Fred Smith, and I would continue to go back and introduce myself and say, remember me? I came to see you once. So, yeah, he's without him doing it directly, he was a mentor.
Now, FedEx is one of the world's largest airlines.
Right.
At what point did you start to build an airline business behind Aramex?
We were never an airline. We're still not an airline. We are a non-asset-based company, and we have taken a decision very early on to be a non-asset-based company. One, because we didn't have the capital. Number two, because we knew it can be done without necessarily building an airline or building assets. It is about the customer experience, and that's where we focused.
Do you think if you had more access to capital in the Middle East that you might be a different company? Because if capital had been easier for you, you might have started an airline and been an asset-rich company.
Right, and luckily not. Yeah, and that's one thing that I would never, if you tell me what would you do differently, I would tell you I would certainly not look for more capital, because the biggest learning experience for us is having to do things on the very cheap, and that created an incredible amount of innovation and creativity inside the organization. We conserved. We were entrepreneurs on one side, but we understood the value of the dollar, and that is what makes us successful today.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Was there ever a turning point in the company? I mean, here you were really just scotch taping things together and improvising your way through building this company. At what point did you say, wow, you know what, we're becoming an institution?
Well, I think by the time Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, in 1990, we had reached a point of having relative stability in the network in the Middle East. Nothing fantastic, nothing fancy, but we had a nice brand with the industry. And then the war comes, and then all hell breaks loose. Kuwait is invaded and occupied. Saudi Arabia airspace was closed. 500,000 American troops on Saudi soil. Airspace in Jordan was closed. We were shut down. And then we had to respond to that crisis internally in the company and manage resources. We had employees in Kuwait then that we came driving to Jordan. FedEx withdrew then. They had some offices in the region, by the way, and said, we're shutting down. You deliver everything for us. So we felt a sense of responsibility, and we felt that even with that crisis, we didn't lay off any people then still, if you want, and we were able to scrap and manage and make sure that the company was intact, even though it was an existential issue. But we thought in crisis, when we responded and we responded together, we said, this is a company that is here to stay. As the war ended, clients appreciated this massively. And from there on, we were the company that has stayed. A lot of banks relied on us at that time. Even, you know, I remember the CEO of the Arab Bank, which is one of the largest banks, the largest bank in Jordan, calling me in the middle of the war and telling me, Fadi, we have these magnetic tapes that we need to secure, and I need them out of this country, and I need you to every single day take these magnetic tapes and take them to a country that is more secure. That was a turning point for us, and that was a turning point for our brand in the region. And from there on, we started building the business from the grassroots up.
By the way, you were married to your business. You were growing the company. What was going on in your personal life at the time?
I was married to the business, and I was married to Rula, who is my wife. We're separated now, but she's still my wife and still a very good friend of mine. And the mother of my two sons. It's a strain on family life.
You're on a plane more than 50% of your time. Do you find that enervating or energizing?
I unfortunately am. How shall I put that? I am an addict of traveling now. Which is crazy, because I feel if I spend more than a week in one place, I am stuck. And one thing I didn't want to do, like my father, was to have that constant travel. But I guess that's one habit I inherited from him. And I'm a curious person. I became much more curious as I grew and realized how little I know, and my drive to knowledge is insatiable. So I am constantly traveling. I'm constantly meeting people. I'm constantly doing things. I mean, that's my life today. And I wouldn't have any other way. I love it. I absolutely love it.
You seem to have a lot of energy. You swim every day, or you try to.
Yeah, that's something I will never compromise on. I've been swimming since as long as I remember.
What does it do for you?
It's the ultimate meditation. So people talk about, you know, yoga and breathing exercises. Swimming is the ultimate breathing exercise, because that's all you're doing. And it just clears my mind. It gives me the energy to go on. I'm disciplined in that. I'm disciplined in my food. I'm disciplined in my work. I'm disciplined in my exercise. Even though I am rebellious and here and there, but when it comes to something which I feel is a responsibility towards myself, towards my family, towards what I do, I am extremely disciplined. I have this sense of responsibility which drives me crazy sometimes.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, a leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. In 1997, you decided to go public on an American stock exchange, the NASDAQ. What was the impetus for that?
We ended up wanting to do a private placement in the region to raise money from Arab capital, if you want. But we failed. We failed miserably because we were a non-asset-based company. At that time, people would ask me, do you own buildings? Do you own aircrafts? What do you own? I said, you know, I don't own anything. We own the client experience. I'm in the package delivery business. I do it well. That's all I own. I have a network. I have strategic alliances. No, we don't own anything. We barely own our cars. So for them, you know, why would you want to value? At that time, I think we were valuing the company at around $30 or $35 million in a private placement. So where's the value then? So we failed. So Bill looks at me and says, you know what, Fadi? We're going to go to NASDAQ. And that scared the heck out of me. I said, Bill, what do you mean NASDAQ? NASDAQ, this company is owned by me and you. Nobody looks at our numbers. We barely audit our numbers. We audit them, but we barely audit them. Legally, we're like 500 different companies. There's no one structure. He said, it can be done. That was August 1996. And luckily, Bill, his biggest gift to us, he also convinced Airborne Express around the same time to give us $2 million for 9% of the company. For the first time, after talking to Airborne for 13 years, they said, okay, here's $2 million. So the biggest check I had ever seen in my life kept me sleeping for quite some time, because I had, you know, a life for an entrepreneur was managing cash flow. Other than making sure packages get delivered, I needed to every morning spend 2 hours with my chief financial officer juggling our payments, because we had such a terrible reputation for being such late payers. But that's life when you're scrapping to run a business. In any case, so Airborne buys 9% for $2 million, and then we say NASDAQ. All by January of 1997, we were on the exchange. So that was miraculous. I can't tell you. And I did the roadshow with Bill. We were only raising $7 million, believe it or not. This was a micro. 2 million of those went to the lawyers and to the banks. We were left with $5 million. And that was the first check that I ever took myself personally as an owner from the Green Shoe. So there was, you know, an oversubscription, and we ended up making, I don't know, $300,000-$400,000 extra. If you tell me what was the turning point, yes, originally what happened in the Iraq-Kuwait war, the reality of the matter, the biggest turning point in our life was us going on NASDAQ, because that made us a legitimate global brand in the eyes of our clients in the Middle East. Nobody had ever done it before. And the respect we got from banks, from clients, from people walking down the street who had heard about the story, until today, we're still called as Aramex, the company that was the first to go public on NASDAQ. It is a stamp on our forehead, and we're proud of it. It's a fascinating story.
It's a fascinating story, especially because you have achieved such success in such an unlikely region. What needs to change?
I'll tell you what needs to change. It needs to have a government system that has a loose safety net. In the Gulf, where there's oil money, there's a huge safety net. The citizen does not feel the urge to innovate or to create or to create his own business, because our education system starts from day one telling us that the government is going to take care of us. We are not taught the skills that entrepreneurs need to be taught. We are not told that private enterprise is legitimate, even though the Prophet Muhammad was an entrepreneur. And he was a traveler in trade, which means he had to deal with people. And the owner of the business was a woman, his eventual future wife. We don't teach our kids because the state is predominant in our life. So we need to change our education system. We need to legitimize and say that entrepreneurship, private enterprise, not working for government is okay, is actually good for you. Having venture capital, angel investors bet on ideas and not bet on hard assets. We love building buildings, but I don't see as many people believing in ideas and believing in entrepreneurs and thus believing in people. But it's not as arid as people think it is. The Arab world is changing very quickly. There is a huge reservoir of entrepreneurs. I'm an angel investor, as you know. I can't tell you the amount of people that come to me on a daily basis asking, showing me their business plans and asking me for either help or advice or capital.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Fadi Gondor, founder of Aramex, the leading logistics and transportation company based in Dubai in the Middle East. Coming up, we'll meet Alex Counts, founder and president of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
The citizen does not feel the urge or to create his own business, because our education system.
I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to make loans to small business owners in almost 40 countries in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Alex founded the Grameen Foundation in 1997 after working with the pioneer of microfinance, Muhammad Yunus, at the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. Alex is the author of Small Loans, Big Dreams. Welcome.
Thank you.
What does Grameen mean?
Grameen, actually, many people think it's the name of the founder of the bank, and in fact, it is just a word in the Bengali language, which roughly translates as rural or village. And Grameen Bank was set up in Bangladesh to fill the gaps in lending. And one of the gaps were there wasn't nearly enough lending in the rural areas and the villages. So that led to the name evolving as the Grameen Bank.
Now, Muhammad Yunus is considered the pioneer of microfinance. What form did microfinance have prior to his coming on the scene?
Well, I think, you know, there's always been lending to people who wouldn't qualify for whatever the traditional lending, bank lending of that era was. People can go back to biblical times. But institutionalizing it, the way I think of it is Ray Kroc didn't invent the hamburger, but he did something with it that no one ever done before.
The founder of McDonald's.
But Dr. Yunus didn't invent lending to the poor, but he actually institutionalized it, franchised it, if you will, in a way that no one had ever done.
When did you first learn about microfinance or about Muhammad Yunus?
When I was at Cornell in the mid-80s, one of the things very striking of that era was there was a lot of student protest. It was Reagan administration, liberal campus, and people were protesting apartheid. And I just saw that I got no energy from working against things I didn't like. And through a series of discussions with mentors, I said I want to find out on issues of poverty and injustice what was working in the world. Dr. Yunus and Grameen Bank came onto my radar screen, and it all started with a letter I wrote him my junior year, where I basically kind of laid out how I thought I could help him expand on a global scale.
What exactly did the letter say?
Well, I'm sure if I could dig the letter up from his files, I'd be embarrassed by it in many ways, because I think I more or less proposed what must have sounded like the Yunus Count's plan to eradicate global poverty. Very simplistic and grandiose, and saying that I'd figured something out over beer and pizza one night in my, you know, on the campus, which is that if Grameen Bank could be applied in all the countries where poverty was pervasive, that you could really start to roll back global poverty. And despite the oversimplification and kind of grandiosity of it, he wrote me back. And he told me that I should first come and learn everything about Grameen, and I should try to learn the language of Bangladesh before I got there. And I was so encouraged that he took the time to write me back that that's exactly what I did.
Were you surprised to get the letter back from him, or were you like, yeah, of course, it's a good idea?
I was pretty surprised. What I was more surprised with is not that he replied, but he really took my idea seriously. And he saw the germ of something really good within me, and I think that's his secret. I think when he walks into a village, you know, he looks at a beggar woman and he sees a businesswoman, and so helps bring out of people their highest potential. So when he saw me reaching probably much farther than I had any right to about what I could do addressing global poverty, he saw in me that even without ever looking me in the eye, that I could do it. And of course, that set me and, you know, got me very excited.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. So you get a reply from Muhammad Yunus, and he says, come to Bangladesh. So after graduation, you hopped on a plane, and what happens next?
Well, I've been fortunate. Both Cornell had a very dynamic language program, so I picked up some Bengali before I got there, which surprised everyone. And it was interesting because I went on a Fulbright scholarship, and there were delegations from the U.S. Embassy and Grameen Bank that went to pick me up. And I had a choice right there, what lifestyle, and I went with the Grameen folks. And for my first year there, I had almost no contact with Americans. I immersed myself in everything Grameen and really became an insider there.
What do you remember specifically? What are some examples of that year? Things that surprised you?
Yeah.
Things that weren't as set up as well as you thought? Or,
well, I think that when I first went out to the villages with Professor Yunus, how he was regarded as something of a kind of a savior, a hero in rural Bangladesh, and the closeness of the loan officers. You know, Dr. Yunus once said to me that if a branch manager who's been in his post for a year doesn't know the names of all the children of the 1,500 borrowers and their husbands' names, then he isn't doing his job, because he's just basically doing a transaction. He's not taking the interest he needs to in their overall well-being. But really, when I saw how, and my language skills got good enough to really draw out of women in conversations how they turn $40 or $60 loan to do something as simple as make cottage cheese and sell it to the shops in Dhaka. When I could draw that out of people in one-on-one conversations, I said, there's something about this that it's so elegant, so simple, and works well. And so that was very striking, that, again, banking, but so much more.
You started Grameen Foundation in 1997. Mm-hmm. Professor Yunus is on the board. And he gave you or lent you $6,000?
Well, what he did do is, around the time that we were setting it up, he had won a prize. But while he was waiting to bring the money into Bangladesh, he had earned some interest in an interest-bearing account. So he gave me the interest. Huh. And he said, this is your seed money to start Grameen Foundation. And so we turned that somehow or other into $100,000 in the first year. So like many things associated with Grameen, it started very small, but it ends up being pretty substantial.
How old were you in 1997 when you started Grameen Foundation?
I had just turned 30.
What were some of the kind of important stepping stones in those in that critical early period, like some important turning points for you?
To begin with, I really wasn't a good fundraiser at all. So a couple times we almost ran out of money. At one point, our auditor told us that our bank balance was down to $200, and I had like six or seven staff at the time. So we were that close to being insolvent. A couple times I didn't even pay myself a salary for three, 4 months in a row, so we didn't run out of money. But I met kind of fortuitously in early 2000, I had a number of microfinance leaders who were applying the Grameen methodology in India, and they said, we need $1 million. And if you give us $1 million at the end of the year, we'll do great things. We can add more than 100,000 borrowers, but we need that up front. And this was what we were set up to do, but I was so intimidated, I was, you know, barely able to keep the lights on at the time. And I joined forces with Steve Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller's grandson, who said he was willing to help me, and we literally raised $1 million in 3 weeks.
How did you meet Steve Rockefeller?
I was invited at the time. Bankers Trust, which later became part of Deutsche Bank, was setting up a microfinance fund, kind of a quasi-commercial, quasi-philanthropic fund. And they were looking for someone new to the field. And so they asked me if I was willing to join the board as an advisor. And he was on the board, and we hit it off. A little mesmerized by his charisma and the name, I said, that's one guy I'm going to try to call and have coffee with. And within a year or so, that concrete project came on. I was panicked about how we were going to ever meet this goal. And I got up my courage to ask him to help me, and he said yes. It was really during that time with Steve's mentorship that I found my voice as a fundraiser. And one of the things I realized is that I was giving these wealthy people an opportunity to be part of something really important, for meaning, for accomplishment that they wouldn't be able to have without me. And suddenly fundraising went from trying to take something from someone and leaving them with less, but really realizing that we're doing a deal with them, we're leaving them with more. Yeah. And I never looked back.
You had another turning point after raising $1 million with the help of Steve Rockefeller a couple years later, where you built your first credit facility, where you created leveraged pools of capital. You were able to raise roughly $30 million, which then could be leveraged to $140 million to loan. What was the catalyst for that?
Well, actually, I mentioned earlier that I raised $1 million with Steve Rockefeller, and we set out to raise $1 million the following year, and we weren't able to do that. We raised only a quarter of that amount for India. This was 2001. The economy had contracted and after the 9/11 attacks. So we were trying to scratch our heads. How do we get more leverage out of a reduced amount? And people thought about, what if we use the money we raised to give some sort of a partial guarantee to Indian banks to lend to these micro-lending organizations, lend them $1 million, and they could then use that to give out a lot of $100 loans, and we would be a kind of a partial guarantor because we had reduced amount of capital. And it actually worked. We used $250,000 to leverage $2.5 million. So we that planted a seed of, my God, we're on to something here. And it might be not just in India. So we did a kind of a long shot. We pulled all these people together in the home of a venture capitalist, John Doerr. Founded Client Perkins, was one of the early investors in Amazon and many of the really great West Coast companies, legendary venture capitalist. And people said, well, what could we actually do now that we've learned about the possibilities of microfinance? And he said, well, I'm told by the Grameen staff that if we were to collectively pledge 0.1% of our net worth, not give it, but pledge it to this loan guarantee pool, they could bring tens of millions of dollars, and probably we would never need to give them a cent, but we need to be willing to lose that amount. And that, people said, well, I might be willing to do that. And so it took us 10 months once we got the mandate from this group, but we were able to put together the facility, and they pledged collectively $31 million, and that allowed us over 5 years, where we were able to leverage more than $150 million, and there was not a single default, and it's funded on more than 1 million microloans.
And you had this meeting at John Doerr's house 8 days after your father died. Talk to me about the intensity of that period.
Well, it was, you know, this is something we'd been building towards. A fundraising colleague, Barb Weber, also a good friend, put it together, and it was so improbable. We weren't that on that strong financial footing at the time, Grameen Foundation. My father's health was uncertain, and I wasn't even sure I was able to go. It was the meeting that had been years in the planning. And yet somehow we pulled it off. And what was interesting was I found myself so kind of emotionally depleted, having just come from my father's funeral, and that one or two of my staff and the one of my board members really took up the leadership role I play. I was very much in the background, and so it was a very complex, exciting negotiation with these 25 individuals who were there, and one that I just got to kind of sit back and observe the team that I'd assembled negotiate that with some of the people, the leaders of industry, and yet doing it really as peers, and that was thrilling.
Grameen Bank and Grameen Foundation is creating ancillary benefits other than simple poverty reduction, for example, decrease in domestic violence or a dissipation of, let's say, Hindu-Muslim conflicts. What are some examples of that?
When I was researching my book, Small Loans, Big Dreams, I met a woman, Amina Begum, who was one of the newest recruits in that village. And one of the things that was really striking is that, well, she had been didn't own any of her own land, nor did her husband, and so she was quite entrepreneurial, raising chickens and livestock, and yet as we learned and we interviewed her over time, sometimes when her husband wasn't there, that she said that her husband, frustrated with their poverty, had often taken in the past to beating her, and actually showed a place where she'd been beaten with a bicycle chain and a scar under her chin that wasn't easily visible. And yet she explained this story that once she joined Grameen, she'd kind of gone into a little bit of agreement with her other borrowing members who said they were going to come by. And knowing that the husband really liked having the working capital for the businesses that they went in together, that they told the husband kind of off the cuff that Grameen had a rule that if there was any abuse and beating in any household, that the loan capital was immediately cut off, which wasn't actually a rule. But they kind of scared him, and from that moment forward, that he neither beat her nor the children because he was afraid of losing the access to that capital. I thought about this village where there was a lot of centuries of the Hindus and Muslims living peacefully together, but in recent decades getting more tense, especially as there were conflicts within India, where it's a Hindu majority, and many of the Hindus that were a little more prosperous were leaving and migrating to India, and it was really leaving a hole in the social fabric of this village, Kolshi, in Bangladesh, which was the name of the village. And yet when Grameen came in and started forming these solidarity groups, borrowing groups, the only way you could do it in most cases was to have groups that were both Hindus and Muslims together, women. And they began to socialize more and establish bonds of friendship. And what was interesting is that when I went back 10 years later to this village in Bangladesh where I'd lived and worked and was researching my book, is that more or less from that time onward, when Grameen had been around for a few years, the whole flight of the Hindus to India had stopped.
What is the default rate among the people you're lending to?
Except in cases of immediately after a natural disaster, typical default rates are 2-3%. So basically the same, more or less the same on commercial loans in the United States.
What percent of the recipients are women?
If you look at the organizations that Grameen Foundation supports, the majority of them are 100% women borrowers. And of the rest, it's anywhere between 50-90%. Microlending and the research shows this, and my own personal journeys to slums and villages is that the women make better credit risks. They also use the profit to help give the children of the next generation the best chance to emerge from poverty by investing in health and education and nutrition of that next generation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is there ever any stigma or trouble that results or resentment among the men because the women are receiving sometimes 100% of microfinance credit?
There's often tension. In fact, in many villages, one that I spent a lot of time in Bangladesh, the men in the village for 6 months didn't allow Grameen to operate. They said, we don't think this is a right kind of bank if you only lend to women. And so Grameen said, well, we'll wait around for a little while, but ultimately we'll just pull up stakes and go. And the men were like, well, this is the only place to get credit at a fair rate, and if you have this crazy policy about lending to women, I guess that's okay. And so, you know, there is tension, and then sometimes there's tension within the family. The man wants to use the loan for another different purpose than the woman applied for it. And this is where the group solidarity comes in, where if a woman is approached by her husband to divert the loan to another purpose, she goes and gets her friends in her borrowing group, and they come and try to convince the husband. And if that doesn't work, they bring the other women, bring their husbands. And if that doesn't work, you bring the staff from the bank so that the money goes into the productive uses that everyone agreed with. One of the things that men, if you talk to men who have had their women come into microfinance, is they'll say something like, I had no idea that my wife had this ability in business. And when she started working in business and earning income, it took pressure off me to have to provide for all the needs of the family. And it was a little shocking to see that part of her come out. But the microloan made it possible, and I saw a whole new side to my wife that I'd never seen before.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that makes loans to small business owners across the globe. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.